Max Blumenthal, welcome to COVID Race and Democracy. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what's important for listeners to know about you and about your work?
Well, I'm the editor and founder of The Gray Zone at thegrayzone.com. And we are an anti-imperialist investigative journalism site. And I'm the author of four books and several documentaries. And journalism is what I do.
All right. And today we're going to focus on the role of the U.S. Empire in Afghanistan. Let's start with a brief historical overview so we have some context for wading through this absolutely endless barrage of lies and sickening propaganda that we're getting every day from the neocons, the neolibs, and the corporate press. Now, you wrote an excellent book, The Management of Savagery, that I think is one of the most well-documented, in-depth analyses of how the U.S. created Islamic fundamentalist armies in the Middle East and Africa. So briefly, summarize for us how the U.S. empowered the forces in Afghanistan that would eventually become Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Well, it's sort of well understood that the U.S., through the Central Intelligence Agency, spent several billion dollars during the 1980s to arm and train the Afghan Mujahideen through Operation Cyclone. That part is known, but in my book, The Management of Savagery, I go back further into the 1970s to show how the CIA, through a series of front groups, was actually sponsoring the ideological forces behind the Mujahideen around Kabul University as Marxism was gaining in popularity in that city and in Afghanistan, and sponsored people like Burhanuddin Rabbani and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who were known as the professors simply. And who they were hardcore far-right Islamists who were professors of religious studies at the university, who were known for organizing attacks not only on Marxist students, but organizing acid attacks on the faces of women who refused to cover. So the CIA had already selected Islamists as their proxies in Afghanistan going back to the 70s. These figures became the chief warlords that the U.S. would rely on to destroy the government of Mohammad Najibullah, which was backed by the Soviet Union, and to draw the Red Army into the morass of Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. At the height of Operation Cyclone, the CIA, or the U.S. government, the Reagan administration, made a sort of matching agreement with the Saudi kingdom. The Saudis agreed to spend $1 for every dollar the CIA spent on the Afghan battlefield. And one of the main figures for sending men and materiel and funding onto that battlefield from Peshawar, Pakistan, close to the Afghan border, was a young Osama bin Laden, who was the scion of one of the most prominent Saudi families, the bin Laden family that ran the main construction firm that renovated Mecca and brought in earth-moving equipment to help build CIA-backed training camps in Khost, the Afghan city on the Pakistani border. And it was through bin Laden alongside Abdullah Azam and Ayman al-Zawahiri that Al-Qaeda was formed out of the Services Bureau that was the cipher for foreign fighters to the Afghan battlefield. They contributed very little in terms of actual combat expertise against the Soviet Red Army, but they brought ideological fervor to the battlefield. And after the Afghan jihad was over, they moved to other areas, Chechnya, Bosnia, with U.S. intelligence assistance, the Philippines as well. And it was then that the monster of international jihad and the organization known as Al-Qaeda, named after the base of the Services Bureau, was born.
And we're supposed to ignore all this history and believe that the U.S. has been spreading democracy in Afghanistan and freeing Afghan women. The U.S. spends at least $300 million every day for the past 20 years to fuel a war that kills hundreds of thousands of Afghans, wounds and displaces millions, and traumatizes the entire country. And now, the apologists for imperialism are crying for Afghan women? So, Max, help us cut through the crocodile tears. Why has the U.S. really been in Afghanistan all these years, and for whose benefit?
Well, I think, you know, a great way to save Afghan women from the cruelty and the draconian Islamist rule of the Taliban would be to evacuate them to Texas, where women are now going to be hunted down by anti-abortion squads if they're suspected of terminating a fetus with a heartbeat. I think the U.S. is a great place to rescue women. We absolutely occupy the moral high ground on all humanitarian interventionist causes. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic, but that's sort of the talking point. And the concept of promoting democracy is what electrifies the think tank sector in Washington and the more ideological areas of the Beltway that are defending a permanent U.S. presence. But the reality of the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan and U.S. involvement in Central Asia is much more materially based on exploitation of resources, pipeline wars, and essentially washing money in a massive money dump. In the 1990s, the U.S. actually enjoyed a favorable relationship with the Taliban. After the warlords that the CIA had trained destroyed half of Kabul, U.S. intelligence and the State Department determined that they were unreliable stewards for U.S. economic ambitions in the area. They were just crazy and unable to protect U.S.-backed infrastructure, pipeline projects like the Unocal pipeline. The Unocal pipeline was central to U.S. geopolitical ambitions because it would have broken the Russian stranglehold on transporting liquefied natural gas to the Caspian Sea. So the State Department organized through the Clinton administration to pay the Taliban to protect that pipeline, and the Taliban was happy to abide. So this is just one example early on that illustrates what the U.S. interest in Afghanistan truly was. And today the U.S. interest is interrupting Chinese infrastructure projects through the Belt and Road Initiative. The Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a huge, important part of the Belt and Road Initiative, the Silk Road, and it goes through Afghanistan. There will be several highways for transporting goods through Afghanistan. The U.S. doesn't want to see that happen. But after 2001, Dick Cheney aligned himself with the neoconservatives, but Dick Cheney is someone who was involved with the oil transport sector, Halliburton, KBR, these kinds of companies. And what Afghanistan provided was perfectly described in a short soundbite by Julian Assange in 2011. It provided the opportunity for the kind of predator class of the U.S. to take trillions of dollars of money from the U.S. Treasury, from U.S. taxpayers, and direct it into their own pockets through contracts to maintain this endless occupation. And you actually saw the landscape of the city that I live in, that I'm from, transformed by the post-9/11 economy. It was also Iraq, but Afghanistan was more lucrative for these forces. And you saw the city grow wealthier and more unequal. You saw a process of rapid gentrification as the mid-level contractors, the people who work in, you know, what we call the Beltway bandits. The mid-level people would move into these luxury apartment buildings that would go up, kind of loft apartments. And then the wealthier people, the executives, the lobbyists, the middle and upper class, turned Loudoun County, which is the far suburb or the exurb in Northern Virginia of Washington, D.C., into perhaps the wealthiest area per capita in the country. This is the result of the post-9/11 economy and all the money that was just siphoned from the U.S. Treasury into Afghanistan and back into the pockets of these contractors, all of these aid organizations, Chemonix, which delivers the aid. I mean, I can just go down the line with the names of Beltway bandits that got wealthy off of this. Joe Biden actually referenced it in his press conference 2 days ago, referring to the Brown University Study of War Project, which found that the U.S. wasted $2 trillion in Afghanistan. And Biden, to his credit, said, consider how much we've lost and how much we could have had, referring to infrastructure at home, high-speed rail, healthcare. That's what Afghanistan represented to our predator class in the U.S.
Yes, but as you mentioned, the predator class was very interested in certain Afghanistan infrastructure, like oil pipelines. So say a little more about the U.S. interest in developing and controlling Afghanistan's strategic minerals.
Well, CNN recently published a very telling headline: Afghanistan has $1 trillion in rare earth minerals that the world needs. And by the world, it's the same way they use the international community as a byword or stand-in for the West. The West needs rare earth minerals. Rare earth minerals will power the fourth industrial revolution, which relies on rechargeable electric batteries. And China has far more rare earth minerals and is more poised to extract and exploit them than the United States right now. So Afghanistan is this, again, key geopolitical friction point between the U.S. and China to get them.
So how was the Taliban able to drive the U.S. and its allies out after 40 years of imperial aggression and trillions of dollars of funding? I mean, we're talking about the most powerful militaries in human history. We're talking about the defeat of an Afghan army that was three or four times the size of the Taliban and much better equipped. So how do we make sense of the defeat of the U.S. and Afghan armies?
Well, first of all, the Afghan army was a phantom. It didn't exist. In many cases, the soldiers who were brought in were Uzbek or Tajik, and were just fighting sort of their own sectarian war against the Pashtun majority. And in other cases, the numbers that the U.S. would report were of ghost soldiers who just simply didn't exist. So the 300,000 number is just a phantom. The other reason that the Afghan army performed so poorly is that it was basically run by warlords. The entire U.S. occupation relied on alliances of convenience with warlords to serve as police in places like the Helmand province. And in 2005, 2006, the warlords that the U.S. relied on had lost control to the Taliban. Why? Because they were sociopathic, despotic fanatics whose forces were not actually police. They were kidnapping members of local families, raping them, raping girls, raping boys to extort money, abusing the local population viciously. And the local population turned to the Taliban for protection from the U.S. proxies. And this was well known in the Obama administration that this was taking place. So for someone like Michelle Flournoy, who was the Pentagon Assistant Secretary for Planning, that they didn't know the level of corruption in 2009 and it only became clear to them later, is just a lie. This is why the whole thing was a failure. It was clearly a failure from the beginning. And generals like David Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal, who marketed themselves as masters of counterinsurgency, convinced Obama to surge U.S. troops to Afghanistan after 2009, from 2010 to 2011. And they did so based on a series of lies to the American public, to Barack Obama, and continued these alliances with these hideous warlords. And the Taliban continued to advance because the local population did not want to be controlled by the forces the U.S. occupation was employing. And it actually all harkens back to the rise of the Taliban in the 1990s, the first time the Taliban took power, for the same reason. The CIA-backed warlords, Hekmatyar, Ahmed Shah Massoud, and Rabbani fought this vicious war of the warlords for Kabul, destroyed half the city, sold off most of the Afghan army to Pakistan, and the government basically collapsed. Afghanistan was turned to a failed state in that period after the Red Army left. And of course, the U.S. refused all attempts by the Soviet Union to negotiate some kind of means of maintaining stability and just handed it over to the warlords. So the population supported Mullah Omar, backed by the Pakistani ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, to restore control. And the Taliban were welcomed as liberators in the 1990s, just as they are today, for the same exact reason. And none of the lessons are being learned. It's all being papered over with this phony narrative about promoting democracy.
So what does the victory of the Taliban and this defeat of the U.S. empire say to the rest of the world?
The Taliban victory sends a strong message, which is, first of all, that the U.S. only understands force because it violated every treaty with the Taliban and essentially had to be driven out by a rapid takeover of Kabul, and that the U.S. and its allies in the region can be defeated by force. All it takes is a determined indigenous resistance group to drive them out. And that message has resonated loud and clear in Iraq, in Syria, areas that the U.S. occupies in hostile fashion without the permission and against the objections of the local population and those countries' parliaments and governments. And they're being resisted by popular mobilization forces. It also resonates in Lebanon and in the Gaza Strip, where indigenous resistance forces are fighting and preparing to fight Israel. In the last encounter between the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli army was fought to a standstill by groups that are completely surrounded, completely under siege, relying on mostly homemade weapons. It was a remarkable result. And then you have Yemen, where Ansar Allah, the Houthis, have essentially destroyed the Saudi military, which is itself relying on mercenaries from Sudan and elsewhere. And I mean, when we talk about the Saudi military, we're talking about the largest importer of arms in the world from the United States that gets the most advanced weapons platforms, from attack jets to THAAD anti-missile systems. And the Houthis have destroyed them in battle after battle and are advancing on the Marib province. So when you look at the Taliban and what they've done, it's obviously an organization that I have no ideological affinity for, but what they've done is demonstrated to the world that the U.S. military, the most powerful, certainly the most technologically advanced military in human history, can be defeated by the determination of indigenous tribesmen.
You know, Max, after the U.S. was defeated in Vietnam, the talking heads and the generals were complaining that the U.S. hadn't done enough, just like they are now. But there was also a lot of conversation about the Vietnam syndrome, which was this idea that the U.S. would not be able to fight future wars in the same kind of way because of the massive public opposition and the costs to empire. And ultimately, the U.S. war strategy was forced to change. And that's why today we have a volunteer army instead of a draft, more reliance on drones and proxy armies than on big U.S. troop deployments, and there's been a shift to less militarized forms of hybrid warfare like economic sanctions. So that all makes me wonder whether we're going to see an Afghanistan syndrome, where the U.S. is again going to be forced to change its strategies in future wars. I mean, just for starters, we're already seeing more reliance on fighting with artificial intelligence, and we're seeing intensifying surveillance and censorship and criminalization of protest movements. What do you think about a possible Afghanistan syndrome?
As you pointed out, Afghanistan was fought by a professional army. You could even call it a mercenary army, since so many of the working class and poor Americans and immigrants who join are doing so for financial reasons, not because they necessarily believe. Biden himself referred to the 1% who sacrifice so much for everyone else and how they should not have to continue to pay the price for a war that doesn't advance American interests. And he referred to his own son, Beau, his successful son, and his death, which left Biden with his fail son, Hunter. His death was the result, in Biden's mind, and I think he's right, of the burn pits in Iraq. He was stationed at a base near one of the burn pits where they were burning ammunition, spare parts, chemicals, and he came back and died of brain cancer. His demise was very fast, along with so many other soldiers. But the pain that those soldiers feel, the moral injury that they've experienced, is not felt throughout the U.S. population the way that it was after Vietnam, when so many were drafted and so many served, and then the educated middle and upper class had to seek exemptions and find ways out, leading to this massive protest movement. There is really no mass anti-war movement in the U.S. because of the professionalization of war and its increasing sophistication, as you mentioned, through the mechanisms of hybrid and kinetic warfare, like the drones, special forces, economic warfare, like sanctions. And that's why I don't think Afghanistan syndrome will play out in the same way. We're also entering an era which the U.S. military, through its own doctrine, calls great power competition, where the wars that took place under the rubric of the wars on terror are no longer what the military wants to fight. The military is sort of angling for brinksmanship against China and Russia because that's how they can justify these budget-busting trillion-dollar appropriations bills that give them all of these huge weapons platforms and justify the need for expanding the Navy. But they've also placed themselves in a serious quandary. And this is what Biden's Afghan withdrawal is about. They're pivoting to Asia. The person who conceived the phrase pivot to Asia is actually back in the Biden administration, Kurt Campbell. He's in the State Department. And they are mobilizing forces around Taiwan, Korea, the whole Pacific Rim, against an army that would solidly defeat them. There is no possible way that the U.S. military could defeat China. In fact, in a skirmish, the United States would be sent into existential panic because the Chinese military is capable, with its standoff capacity, of destroying a U.S. aircraft carrier in seconds and obliterating U.S. bases across the Pacific all the way to Guam in a matter of minutes. And the Chinese population is more mobilized, more capable of withstanding casualties. The U.S. would have no alternative except to consider some kind of nuclear strike, which actually, as Gareth Porter has reported for us at the Gray Zone and has been revealed through new releases in the Pentagon Papers, the U.S. has previously considered. Does the U.S. want to go that far? No. So it's basically blocked. And it's blocked in Ukraine as well, where it and its forces, NATO forces, would be wiped out in any artillery barrage by the Russian military. The Russian tank divisions are the best. Their artillery battalions are the best. And the U.S. cannot pour in armor on Russia's frontiers the same way Russia can. So they're blocked there, too. So where does this leave the U.S.? It leaves the U.S. with, again, its drones, its sanctions regime, where it's placed one-third of the world's population under sanctions. And the only place it can go is backwards. So I think we've reached a sort of pivot point in imperial decline. Meanwhile, our predator class is going to garner as much profits as it can by ramping up these conflicts that it knows it can't win.
So what do you see as the key lessons of this defeat for those of us who are anti-imperialists and for those who want to build an anti-war movement here in the U.S.? What do you think is most critical to learn and to do at this juncture?
Well, the highest point of the anti-war movement in my lifetime was during the great mobilizations against the Iraq War. We haven't seen anything since. And I remember in the days after 9/11 protesting outside the federal building in Los Angeles, the Westwood Federal Building, and being among this tiny band of righteous people who knew where this was going. And we were distinctly in the minority, even in our own liberal city, where passersby would heckle us, call for our deaths. And I kept returning to that building with small groups, and the groups kept getting bigger and bigger until the protests turned into these massive mobilizations with hundreds of thousands of people. The anti-war movement, sectors of it embraced Obama, and that was their downfall. And we can see under Democratic presidents, the anti-war movement often falls asleep. So it's important to mobilize now more than ever and to recognize that the face of war is changing and that the preferred U.S. mechanism is sanctions, unilateral coercive measures that kill almost as many people as any traditional war. As former U.N. Rapporteur on sanctions Alfred Desaia said, these sanctions are actually medieval sieges imposed on countries like Venezuela Cuba, Iran, now Belarus, they need to be opposed at every turn. And we need to explain to Americans what it means to impose these kinds of child-starving sanctions. We need to oppose regime change in every instance when so much of the left gets captured by phony humanitarian interventionist narratives about saving the children in Syria. We need to explain the consequences of military intervention. And that's why I wrote The Management of Savagery, just to remind people of the history of Libya and Syria and how destabilizing those countries destabilized entire regions and changed our politics and moved our politics to the right. And finally, it's important for the anti-war movement to just avoid infighting, but that seems impossible at the point we're at right now.
Well, thank you for saying all of that, Max, because I really agree that people in this country do not understand that economic sanctions are a form of warfare and just how devastating these different forms of hybrid warfare are for the people of the world. And many people do not see the complicity of the Democratic Party in all of this. The Democrats control the main levers of government, but there's now bipartisan support for a $778 billion defense budget in 2022. So the Democrats are fully on board with the Republicans for the next rounds of imperialism.
Yeah, and they're thinking about just creating jobs in their own districts. They're not even thinking about lost lives or starting a peace economy. It's military Keynesianism, and that's the closest the Democrats can ever get to social democracy.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you want to address that I haven't asked you about, or any final thoughts that you want to leave us with?
Well, if you want to ask about COVID or race.
I'm keeping an eye on time for your benefit, Max, but if you have time, here's one more question. I'm wondering what you think the Taliban's victory will mean for the people of Afghanistan. We've already addressed how the U.S. manipulates this issue for its war propaganda, but how would you frame it from your perspective?
Well, obviously, the population of Afghanistan that is secular and liberal has been shunted to the side again, just as it was after the Soviet-backed government was forced out. So this is nothing new. There were spaces where women could advance more during the past 20 years. I don't think we can deny that. But it's not the United States' job to perpetuate liberalism around the world at the point of a gun. And it obviously was a failed project that most Afghans resisted. The Taliban is more professional than it was in its first incarnation. They're obviously attempting a public relations campaign to be accepted by the international community, which means that they are more malleable. They received a lot of direction and training in exile in Doha, Qatar. Qatar, of course, is the home of the largest U.S. air base in the Middle East and has close relations with the U.S. And they've pledged to not take a sectarian line against Afghan's Shia minority, to provide women with some opportunities. I don't know if that can be trusted, but it's also important to look at the Taliban's emerging alliances, and they are signaling that they want to form an economic alliance with China and get in on a lot of those win-win trade deals that countries like Pakistan are participating in. So that will be interesting as well. And what China has told the Taliban is you can do whatever you want as long as you close the back door and don't let jihadist groups like the East Turkestan Islamic Movement wage war on our frontiers and attack us. There's also Russia, which is right in the region, and Russia is very, very concerned about the rise of ISIS-K and other jihadist forces. And so I think the Taliban's ace card here is counterinsurgency, that they will actually crack down on these jihadist forces that threaten regional partners and which threaten the United States. It's remarkable to hear the CENTCOM commander and Pentagon brass declare without any hesitation that they will work with the Taliban and coordinate with the Taliban to fight ISIS-K. So I think we're looking at the domestic politics of the Taliban being overlooked for national security concerns by the quote-unquote international community. And what takes place there will be obviously a more conservative kind of regime, but also one that appears to reflect the wishes of most Afghans. And that's something that we just have to respect.
And I thought you addressed some of those issues really well in the podcast that you and Ben Norton did with Pepe Escobar. And that leads me to ask what sources of information you would recommend for people who want to learn more or get active.
Well, yeah, at the Gray Zone, we try to help people see the other side of the story that isn't being reported by corporate U.S. media, and to bring in credible alternative voices who have experience on the ground. So Pepe was one person we brought in. We got a really strong response from our audience at Moderate Rebels, the podcast I co-host with Ben Norton, which you can find at our YouTube channel at The Gray Zone and at its own exclusive channel. Pepe writes for Asia Times, which is a great source of reporting on Central Asia, on Afghanistan. And, you know, I just think that it would be a waste of time and energy for me to try to rattle off different sources. But you should know that when you're reading the New York Times, Washington Post, or watching any of the three main corporate news channels, you're only getting one side of the story. And it's the side of the story that the State Department and the rest of the U.S. regime wants you to hear. And so you have to look for alternative sources, whatever they are, and balance them against what you're hearing through what effectively is an information war against the American public.
Well, I appreciate that. And I really think the Gray Zone has been unparalleled for the depth of investigative reporting and analysis that it offers. So in addition to the Gray Zone website, we'll refer listeners to the different programs under the Gray Zone umbrella: Pushback, Red Lines, Moderate Rebels, and the two new Rockfin podcasts, Foreign Agents and Propaganda Today. So is there anything else you want to add, Max?
Well, yeah, I mean, you brought up the Rockfin podcast. I mean, that's a place where I can talk about issues that are being censored by YouTube. So definitely subscribe to my new Rockfin podcast, Foreign Agents. And, you know, we're talking about COVID and the way that the ruling class is exploiting the pandemic to deepen its control. And we are unable to talk about this on YouTube, which is another facet of ruling class control. So Rockfin has given me a platform that's sort of a sanctuary, and I'm going to use it to the fullest extent possible.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I so appreciate you taking this time to share your really deep knowledge and insights with us. And thank you for your courage. Your anti-imperialist journalism and activism is inspiring, and it means a lot to all of us.
Thanks a lot, Ken. Thanks for what you do.